Good morning. I'm your host, Claudia Shambaugh, welcoming you to the May 9th, 2023 edition of Ask a Leader. Today, Virginia Parks, UCI Professor of Urban Planning and Public Policy, will present her recent findings on how the closure of a Marathon refinery affected its displaced workers, a story of the challenge in transitioning to renewable energy. The full report was done for the UC Berkeley Labor Center, and her co-author was Ian Baran. As well, we're going to continue coverage of the South Coast Rep after the completion of their Pacific Playwrights Festival with playwright and performer Michael Cheyenne. He'll bring phenomenal storytelling in his world premiere Avaz, which was workshopped and developed at last year's Pacific Playwrights Festival. Avaz is running now through May 27th at the Segerstrom Stage in Costa Mesa. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the show. My first guest is Virginia Parks, UCI Professor of Urban Planning and Public Policy, here to present her recent findings on how the closure of a Marathon refinery up there in the East Bay in San Francisco area, the effects of the refinery closure on workers in that Bay Area. And this article, Fossil Fuel Layoff, the Economic and Employment Effects of This Closure on Workers in the Bay Area, is co-written by Ian Baran and published at UC Berkeley's Labor Center. It's a work mapping out the paths that energy conversions can take on whose back the burden has been borne so far. We'll talk about that. We'll explore that with her today. Professor Parks is a geographer and urban planner specializing in the study of urban inequality. Her research and teaching interests include labor and employment, racial and gender inequality, urban politics and policy, and local economic development. Virginia Parks has published research on the racial wage gap, low-wage group, immigrant employment patterns, public sector jobs, workplace diversity, job training, commuting disparities, and the politics of urban development. Throughout this work, Virginia Parks is concerned with how urban space politics and regulatory environments influence inequality outcomes. Prior to her appointment at UCI, she was on the faculty of the Urban and Environmental Policy at Occidental College. Both the School of Social Service Administration and the Center of Study of Race, Politics, and Culture at the University of Chicago, and was a visiting scholar at Russell Sage Foundation, New York City. Over a couple of decades is her community service, of which I'd like to take note. Co-founder, Faculty Support Committee, Unite Here Local 1, and that hotel union we've talked a bit about several times at Ask a Leader. Board member, Arise Chicago Worker Center, a member of the Workers' Rights Board, Jobs with Justice in Chicago, and a member of the Los Angeles Metropolitan Alliance. She completed her Bachelor's of Arts in Humanities and History, and there you go, folks. That's where humanities can take us, at the University of Colorado, and both her Master's in Urban Planning and her PhD in Geography at UCLA. She joins me in studio. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Virginia Parks.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm so glad you're here. First, I want for all of us to hear from you, be reminded of the conditions that were taking place when Marathon shut down in October 2020. And I maybe to start with, how much were the workers given advance notice of this closure? Or maybe it was already kind of in the water supply. Everybody knew it was coming. What are those conditions?
No, they had no idea that it was coming. It was COVID, to remind everybody. There was depressed demand for gasoline because we were all staying home and not driving. So the refinery had slowed down and workers, you know, were concerned, but this was happening everywhere, right? And it was impacting all refineries across the country in the same way. They had no idea that a closure was coming. This is a refinery that had been in continuous operation for 107 years before it closed in late October 2020. This is a refinery that had weathered World War I, the Great Depression, the oil crisis of the 70s, the Great Recession of earlier in this century. So this didn't seem like something that was going to be greater than that.
One other factor I'm thinking, they weathered also adjacent massive sorts of fire kinds of catastrophes at other refiners. And I don't know what the history was at this Marathon plant. So that's not an insignificant kind of a development, too, that they're bobbing and weaving in.
Exactly. And workers told me that this refinery in the Bay Area, this refinery is located in Martinez in Contra Costa County. They told me that this refinery was known for refining the dirtiest crude and bringing it up to California standards. So they thought that they had a particular niche in the market as well. They were given 90 days, which is required by federal law, but that's not a lot of time. And these are workers who really stay in these jobs. They're good union jobs. The union is very active. There's a lot of on-the-job training. There's an incredible attention to safety. Refinery work is incredibly hazardous. I didn't know much when I started this project, but by the time I was done, you know, over 2 years, I've really learned a lot about the nature of the work. And there had been deaths at that refinery in the late 1990s, and many workers had been employed, and they shared that experience, you know, not in great detail, because I think it's very hard, but with great reverence and respect. And that really solidified that safety culture that many workers talked about. So, you know, again, it's a job that people, once they got into, believed that this would be a job that they would retire out of.
And I want also bring another factor in that 90 days they had to quickly resolve a lot of complicated human resource sorts of things. There's also homeschooling of COVID kids at this is pre-vaccination. Mm-hmm. So there is so much they already are exhausted from, mm-hmm. and to be able to respond immediately with their career development in a 90-day window, I just want to make sure we keep remembering what was going on in October 2020.
Absolutely. You know, this was really a moment of uncertainty and insecurity for lots of folks. And those workers are experiencing those conditions as well. The majority of workers that in that refinery have children at home. So it really stretches the age span. There are definitely a number of older workers, again, because they stay there. But a majority of workers have children living at home under the age of 18. And, you know, this is what they're juggling as well. In fact, some workers, so I interviewed a subset of workers that I also surveyed, said that they made the decision to stay at home with the children, and their wives started looking for jobs or more hours. Many of their partners were employed, but they upped their hours in order to, you know, meet the household budget. And these guys decided to, you know, stay at home. I want to say there are women who work at the refinery,
sure,
but it is a majority male workforce.
So I would like, and at the risk of being irreverent here about, because you know, it's a very carefully developed kind of study that you did, but we don't have a lot of time to go in a sort of a broad stroke of the survey. I think you surveyed 345 workers.
Yes.
And so if you could give us a little idea quickly about the protocol and what some of those questions are. I mean, you've given us a little idea of what you were asking. Did you have this data? But
sure,
a little bit of the project design.
I do want to share this because it is an unusual study. There's not really anything like it right now in the United States, nor has there been a study like this done in a long time. And if people know of one, please let me know. It's a carefully constructed research design. So in that sense, you know, it really hits the bar for academic rigor. I was able to contact every single unionized worker who worked at that refinery when it shut down. And so that's unusual to have that full list.
Huge.
So I had 345, you know, names, contact information. And from that, I got a 41% response rate, which is very high for a survey of this kind. Workers received an email or a letter, because actually not everybody had an email address. They had mailing addresses. Thank goodness, though, for email, because a number of the workers had moved out of state. So I was able to contact them because of the email. I built a survey online, and it's an in-depth survey. There's always a risk when you survey folks. There's a risk of asking too many questions, right? So on the one hand, I'm trying to balance, I really want to know a lot and grab information that we're not able to see in larger surveys of displaced workers. But I also need them to hang in there and complete the survey. And I only had a handful of folks who didn't finish all of the questions, but they finished the most important questions.
Wow.
So that was really fantastic. I can tell you more about those questions as we maybe get into the interview, but I, of course, wanted to know what were they doing right then and there. That was the most important thing. Did they have a job or were they unemployed? And what was the wage? Those were the two critical questions.
So when did you start asking the questions if the shutdown was in October 2020? When did the survey move out?
December 2021, because it takes, because I didn't know about these workers, right?
So well, that's why you got to get the clearance with the human subjects protocols.
Well, you got to get the money.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I mean, this is very expensive. So it took time to get the money, right? Establish a relationship with the union because they're the ones who have the contact information. That takes a lot of time in relationship building. And we had to be clear about this was going to be, you know, were they interested? But if they were, there could be no interference on their part. And oftentimes, organizations are very leery because they don't know what you're going to find. And I had a very willing partner in this union president who was devastated by what had happened, devastated by what had happened to his members, and knew that he wasn't prepared. And he wanted to know what had happened. I kept saying to him, Tracy Scott, do you want to know or do you not want to know? It's one or the other. Either you already think you know the answers and then you don't need me. And he said, no, I want to know because we need to learn so that the next time this happens, and it's coming with the transition, that we are prepared and that we really know what workers need. Who am I to say what I think my members need? He said, that's very paternalistic. I want to know what they need, and I can't know that. I can't crawl into their brain. I can't crawl into their lives. We need to ask them. So that was remarkable to, as a researcher, have that sort of trust and clearance, and, well, I should say runway. You know, they stepped out. I didn't talk to him again until I was completely done. So that was really a privilege and I think rare often for researchers to have that kind of access. I started, so it takes time to, you know, get the money, set up those relationships, get the clearance to go in. And so I was able to, we talked about the survey going live. In it was early December 2021, which isn't great timing before the holidays, but actually we were able to catch a number of people. And people then, I think, just from seeing when people responded, people had time off during the holidays and took time to fill out the survey. Most folks filled it out in January. That's where I have, so January of 2022. I kept it open through March, but that was just to, I had to chase down a few folks who were difficult to get, but I needed them. So you get five chances. This is an IRB rule, right? You get five opportunities to contact somebody. And I exhausted that with my last group of folks. And I, in fact, did get responses. And so those tend to be people who have moved, right?
Right. They're
disconnected, right, from their life before. But I needed that information to have a representative sample. Then what I did, and this is also, I think, very unusual for these types of studies, is I have a sampling frame within a sampling frame, if you will. So my sampling frame to start out was all the unionized workers at that refinery. And by that, I mean, it's a closed shop. So those are basically all the workers, but not contractors or management. Then, based on survey results, I then selected people who I would interview, making sure, right, that they were reflective of the sample of respondents that I had received through the survey. And I did those interviews I did on Zoom. You know, I wasn't sure. We weren't sure what was happening. I thought maybe I would fly up to Contra Costa and talk to these folks. But we didn't know what was happening with the vaccine. We didn't know when one was going to come on, when it was going to come
online.
Yeah, and
there's super spreaders that are, and there's new strains that were massively lethal.
Exactly. We look back now and we think we know what happened during COVID. But at that time we thought, well, at any minute, the world might go back to normal. Well, I actually think that might have helped a lot because the Zoom interviews allowed folks to be in their homes and talk to me. And most of the time we did these in the evening, anywhere between actually 7:30 and 9:30 at night. And I do think people opened up to me more as a result of that. They were comfortable at home. And, you know, I had some folks who spent 2 hours with me. So it was a real privilege that they opened their lives to me, that they shared as much as they did. And it's reflective in the report. And I really hope that that makes a difference for policy as we move forward, because this is going to happen to thousands of workers as we move forward in the clean energy transition, which we should.
Hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, exactly. You're exactly right. And we must do it, but we know the transition is coming. And that's what's different from, right, a pandemic. You don't know what's coming. All of a sudden, masses of people are out of work. Here we know. And so we have time to put into place a safety net that's not only there to catch workers, it's there to catch their families and their communities as we think about transitioning and moving these economies onto clean energy and onto what we call high road development. So a path of regional economic development that will produce good paying middle class jobs.
For those of you who've just joined us, my guest is Virginia Parks, UCI Professor of Urban Planning and Public Policy, Director of UC Irvine's Labor Center, speaking today on how the closure of a Marathon refinery affected its displaced workers. She's just talking about the study design and how she was able to artfully get some amazing data unlike any other place. So we have so much more to cover if we can just zip through. So there's a lot of demographics I'm interested in. I don't know if you've got a thumbnail demographic to represent who's involved, the age, that you've already talked about the gender, the duration of the employee. You've already talked a bit about that, but not the ethnicity, or work history.
And I am realizing that I do not have the study in front of me, so I will, to the best of my recall ability.
Well, it's just the salient of demographics.
So this is a majority male workforce. However, there are a number of women, and I did something that researchers do. I oversampled women because I very much wanted to get their experience, and they are... Well, in my mind, they're very good super operators. So these are the folks that sit at these huge consoles and they're watching everything that's happening in the refinery.
You saw one.
I have not seen one, but I've seen them online, what they look like. But these women would describe them to me and the other men who worked as super operators. So they're watching everything that's happening in the refinery. And if they see a pressure gauge that goes up too much, right, they're the ones that are telling everybody on the ground, okay, go check this, go check that. So these were really amazing jobs that they have. They're very stressful. They require a very cool head and juggling a lot at once.
A little air traffic control there, energy.
It's exactly. That's a okay. good. I love that. I might steal that from you.
No, it's yours. It's yours. You're my guest. You use
and
everything.
And these are
you get.
Women who. So I talked to one woman who, as a result of the shutdown, chose to take early retirement. And this was a story among a number of folks. They did not want to take early retirement. They weren't prepared to take early retirement, but they felt that they had no choice. And that is an important takeaway from this. We must find a way to bridge folks to retirement, because these are workers who really only have a couple more years left, right? That's their plan. And it's not, you know, they have no interest in retraining, finding a new job, right, to carry them through that last 2 or 3 years. But those last 2 or 3 years can be the difference between a secure retirement and an insecure retirement. So that is a challenge that we must address. But the other women that I talked to had children at home. They have kids. And by and large, my women ended up in jobs that were lower paying than other jobs. And that's an interesting, I did not put in the study, but I am working on okay. some of those data, because I think that this is where you start to see how other forms of inequality, now that union job guarded against, because those are wages that everybody gets paid the same in those different
there's a collective.
Yes, and those different occupational categories. And so that brings equity, right, to that workplace. But now the labor market outside is very unequal. And so these workers are going to find themselves now impacted by those forces of inequality that they had been, that union job buffered them against, right? Then, you know, we have a majority of white workers, but because it's the Bay Area, we do have Latino workers. We have a few Asian American workers. I had a worker who self-identified as Native American. So this was one thing that one of the environmental justice groups that works closely with the union in Contra Costa County and thinking about just transition and what that means, that it's both workers and fence line communities. They were somewhat surprised to see that the workforce was more diverse than they had thought beforehand. I do want to talk about the tenure of these folks.
Yes, that's important.
The sort of the median and the average are pretty close. It's about 11 years. That's a lot, right? In a labor market where we see people transitioning a lot, moving, you know, in and out of different jobs. So it really speaks to the fact that workers stay in these jobs. One worker, 40 years, and he was still planning on working another year or two. He said, I'm fine to take retirement. He loved his job. But this is what you really see. A number of workers are interviewed had been there, you know, 15, 20, 22 years. Again, good jobs, stressful, difficult jobs, but jobs that paid well and provided a safe working culture. And that became a very important finding that was of great surprise to me. Workers participated in the Great Resignation, like many workers did at that moment in time. Of course, they didn't know that they were participating in that. But a majority of workers a year after layoff had worked at least 2, if not more, jobs. And I was able, in my survey, I asked them, okay, what are you doing now? And then I asked them to go back in time. And I actually had a matrix that I asked them to fill out. You know, okay, you have this job now. How long have you been there? What job did you have before? How long were you there? Did you have another job before that, right? And I didn't think that I needed as many. I just added a whole bunch of columns to this matrix because you never know. I had people filling in.
Column after column.
Four,
because it just dropped
jobs.
Off from the long employ to.
Exactly.
Not just
churning.
And keep working and just turning over.
Turning over. And the number one reason was hazardous working conditions. And they said, listen, I'm coming from a safety culture that was finely honed, was a culture. They would talk about, it wasn't just about, and I'm sort of adding, well, no, some of them use that term, sorry, safety culture. But even in that sort of academic idea that we understand of culture, what makes culture, the habit of culture, that was ingrained, and it was something that was, it was incredibly important to these workers. And as soon as they found themselves in a work site where it was evident that that wasn't part of the culture, management didn't care about it, workers didn't have knowledge or experience, they said, listen, I know what the risks are. I am not willing to risk limb or life. No job is worth that. And so they would quit to find a new job. And a few folks said, listen, I took a job at lower pay, but did not present the same hazardous working conditions.
That's such an irony that a very hazardous, potentially hazardous kind of a workplace like a refinery, that they could be shut down from that employee and moving into other jobs that become more hazardous because the connective tissue of the union looking after them was gone.
Exactly. I love that term, connective tissue, because that's exactly what was at play in this refinery. Folks would come in, right? This is a union. This is the United Steelworkers. The union that the predecessor is the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers. And OCAW has developed over decades a robust model of worker-to-worker training. In fact, now in Pittsburgh, there is a training center named after a very well-known OCAW labor leader, Tony Mazzocchi, because when they merged with United Steelworkers, the steelworkers understood, right, the import of this culture that OCAW had developed really across the country in different refineries. I'm from Colorado. My first job out of college actually was organizing with the OCAW. I actually had no idea, though, that this steelworker local had been an OCAW local when I decided to do this study. So that I sort of felt like I was coming full circle in my own career. And the OCAW International was based in Denver, and that's who I worked with. And I actually worked on a healthcare campaign. So I wasn't working in the refineries, but I was exposed to the culture of this union. And it is very focused on, you know, solidarity and a collective approach to problems on the shop floor. So that, again, worker-to-worker training culture was incredibly important. And working with management, right? There was an agreement, right, between labor and management that this was good for both sides, right? That good safety practices for workers are good safety practices for the boss, and they're good for the local community because those sorts of practices mean you're going to have fewer flares, fires, incidents at the refinery.
So let's rapidly close with the remedies for the displacement, the dislocation of the workers. There's so many fronts where, and I'd like for you to hone in on, you have a lovely list of recommendations mm-hmm. in your publication, but to zero in on who's got the resources to make this transition better, that we have state funding, we have federal funding, and some of those relief acts that were only mm-hmm. legislated in 2021. But where are the best, and does Marathon have any mm-hmm. at all, any sorts of responsibility to their workers that they have laid off? Not laid off, they have shut down. And that complicates their relocation, re-entering, maintaining their employee, because there's, with the shutdown, everybody's gone. So that's a huge pool that needs to find the few jobs that are around. So where are the resources that you like the most or think we ought to be looking to applying more pressure because they are a responsible party in underwriting the mm-hmm. losses here mm-hmm. that these workers are incurring still?
So first, let me just a quick takeaway. 3 out of 4 workers had found jobs a year after layoff, but still 26% were unemployed a year after layoff. Those workers who found jobs found them at a cost. They took a 24% wage cut. And they're not going to hit their pre-layoff wage anytime
soon. Or compensation package.
Or a compensation package, and they may never. So that's the reality of what a shutdown looks like. We as the public must play a role, right? There must be state and federal funds that contribute to, one, just cash payouts to these workers. This, there's a cost to transitioning the economy, but it's a cost that's worth it, and we should pay. We need money for programs that are about, are, that are targeted, that are quick interventions that connect workers to new opportunities. Training is not necessarily one of them. I want to be very clear about.
Okay, good. Okay,
because these are high-skilled workers already. What they don't have, though, is a degree or a piece of paper that says, hey, I can do all these things. And that was another surprising finding. They lack certification of their skills. Actually, the certification is carried by the refinery. So a refinery has all these different certifications, and it's largely based on the skill set and competency of their workers.
But that's a marathon could be institutionalizing some kind of a credential that can follow the shutdown workers.
Exactly.
So that's on them.
What we need is a partnership between the employer, the union, and the state. Those are three actors that need to come together so that not just one controls it. I think that's important. The employer could do it, but we don't want them controlling all of that, right? And I think good actors would be interested in this.
But they've got resources to underwrite this effort.
Absolutely.
To codify a certification that follows the worker.
Absolutely. Simply verifying employment. That was one thing that Marathon refused to do.
Why?
They refused to verify employment before they took ownership of the refinery, which was only a couple years before it was shut down. So that is something that we could just legislate, that you must take all of those HR records that came with that plant when you bought it and make those workers whole and verify their employment from the day that that worker started work at that refinery, right, at that plant. So those are things that can happen. Tony Mazzocchi talked about a super fund for workers. So this was back in the early 90s. And he said, listen, super fund is a model. Those who create the problem, create the mess, create the toxic waste should be responsible for cleaning it up. We need a super fund for workers. We need a transition trust fund for them. And multiple stakeholders should be paying in to make that happen.
Okay. Then I don't know if there's, you've given us some kinds of the, you know, takeaways, and there are, the theme in your work is that we need to be consulting with the workers. They need an ownership in working their way out of this. It's a respect because of, it's acknowledging the burden, the inordinate burden placed on them to work this transition to renewable energy. So I don't know if there's any other kind of parties that are really good entities to coalesce with the workers and besides us as individuals, mm-hmm. citizens of the state and the country.
Well, their labor unions need to be involved with this,
okay.
and provided a front and center seat. This needs to be a worker-centered transition. We need worker-centered policy that puts workers at the center, and their trusted partners are their labor unions. Unions can even be involved in the role of benefit negotiators. So they don't necessarily need to become service providers. We shouldn't ask that of them. But they can receive funds or grants that allow them to connect their members, their workforce, with a set of resources. Because workers trust who they're closest to, and that's usually their labor partner.
Okay. Wow. This has been so edifying. I'm so glad, Virginia, you could bring all of this to us. And I know there's more. And I don't know, are you going to follow up with the 345 that you've already approached? Are you going to add more people? Are you going to continue this study?
That's a great question. I don't know right now. That hadn't been the plan when we first went in. You know, I just wanted those two questions. Are they employed? You know, what wage are they making? But I'm thinking very much about the larger ecosystem of transitioning regional economies. And that's where my work is moving. And how do we construct and curate, if you will, a process that puts workers at the center?
So thank you for all of this today, Virginia Parks. As I said, it's really been very edifying. Thank you for being on Ask a Leader today with us.
Well, a privilege to be here. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Thank you. My guest was Virginia Parks. She is the Urban and Planning Public Policy Professor with this beautiful work she's done on the Marathon Refinery. Stay tuned, and we're going to talk with Michael Cheyenne about Avaaz, the play that he has written and he's performed in. Be right back. Don't go away. Thank you for staying tuned, all. My next guest is Michael Cheyenne, playwright, performer of the world premiere Avaaz, presented at the South Coast Repertory at the Segerstrom Theater at the Segerstrom Center for the Performing Arts Center in Costa Mesa. Michael is a Sunrise Uprise Fellow, staff in the Global Content Marketing Division. Well, we're just going to go a little bit of the labor history and some of the art history. He's a staff in the Global Content Marketing Division at Twitter. He's a brand guy, among other roles, at Google, board member of the New Conservatory Theater Center in San Francisco. His honors include his recent Emmy nomination, along with the Kennedy Center and Lambda Literary and much earlier Workplace Corporate Awards. I have to say that. Michael completed his Bachelor's of Arts at Harvard University, the third best university in the world, his MFA in playwriting from Brooklyn College, and we don't know what number that is. And his earliest artistic training draws from life in the Tarantulis burbs and shops, his teenage gigs at the Hollywood Magic Castle, then on to the Ojai Playwrights Conference, La Mama, and theater in Aspen. His plays have been developed at the Geffen Playhouse, New York Stage and Film, Rattlesnake Theater, The Lark, Play Development Center, Project Y Art House, and Dixon Place. He will be a fellow at the Sun Valley Writers Conference later this year. He comes to us today from, I don't know, while you're doing this run, Michael, where are you coming today from?
Hello, it's such a pleasure to be on. I am here in Costa Mesa.
Oh, you're going to be hanging in Costa Mesa. Welcome to Ask a Leader, Michael Cheyenne.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you so much.
So, congratulations. Your storytelling really raises the bar for others who will attempt that craft. Your witticisms are contagious, and your teaching style most subversive. We're going to get to that. Subversive for white people and respectfully triggering for Persians. So, but first, Michael, the ground rules here are no obscenities, profanities, or indecent language during this time slot on Community Radio, since my Persian hermana noticed you flung a few Farsi, a few obscenities in Farsi at Avaaz. So we just got that as we continue, because we don't want to get fined here. So speaking of speech, Avaaz means special things, many things. So let's have you help our listeners out, whose Farsi is slim like mine is, folks who haven't heard of you yet or had the show. And it's an obvious title now, but I don't know if it was a trial to put this one word into this title of the play about your mother.
Yeah, Avaaz is a play about my mother's journey from Tehran to what I call Tarantulis, California, formerly known as Westwood. And I play my mother, which is, every gay man's dream or nightmare, depending on how much you love your mother. I am embodying her story and her history, coming from Iran. And she left during the 1980s. And, this is really my way of understanding my mother, exploring our mother-son dynamic. Through these different lenses of body and gender and, looking at it through my lens of queerness. And Avaaz, the title, So the title means, so Avaz is an untranslatable word, and it means, loosely translated, it means a song as it's being sung, a song in the process of being sung. And I thought that was so beautiful. And when I thought about my mother's story, you know, it felt like her song was very much in process. You know, I grew up, she was a single mom, and she was putting me through school while she was working 2-3 jobs at a time. You know, we would come home together and do our homework. We would, you know, we would spend a lot of time together. And it felt like we were sort of growing up at the same time. And so it felt like her song was still in motion, and also the song of Iran and the Iranian people. You know, right now, women, students, everyone is out on the streets calling for woman, life, freedom. And it feels like the song of my motherland is still very much also in process and in motion. So I didn't plan that connection, but a lot of folks have been saying that sort of resonates for them, and that's been so touching and so moving.
And you're saying you didn't plan that connection, but it is one elegant production with layering, as I mentioned in the introduction, layering so many different elements. You're speaking to so many different kinds of audiences, I want to make sure that it's not lost on listeners, so that they, you know, they make sure they get there before through May 27th is their opportunity in this 100 minutes of a play that you bring to us. So right out of the gates, we are treated to the concept of tarof, deeply baked into the Persian psyche, and the non-heritage folks, just, we don't know it's going on. It's sort of like we never know how to do that bow with Japanese individuals. And so we botch it up. We don't know how to navigate that. We don't know what's going on. But you start. I would say tarof starts when you are working the audience. You are walking, as an obvious character in your play, walking through the audience before you get to the stage. So you are getting so much done in so many gestures, explanations, and effects on the stage. So you were saying you kept bringing in more and more and more details. It was a phenomenal process to put this play together, I imagine.
Oh, thank you so much for those words. I mean, it's been really quite a beautiful process, an intense one, and I'm just, you know, blown away by the feedback that we've gotten, the love that we've gotten from the community. You know, I started working on this play a couple of years ago. I interviewed my mother. I don't know if I told you this story. I interviewed my mother because when I was a kid, she really didn't speak much about her past. It was kind of this like forbidden subject. And I really was always curious about it, and I was always connected to my Iranian heritage and my roots. But, you know, there were a lot of gaps in my understanding. So I interviewed her, and I set down a tape recorder, and I started asking her questions about her past and her history and her time in Iran. And I think the formality of that interview sort of opened something up for her, gave her permission to talk about things that she had never told me. And so that interview stayed with me. And then when I was at Lemda Literary Retreat, Luis Alfaro, who was leading the workshop, had us do this exercise where we put our hands over our hearts.
Yes.
And imagine the heartbeat, feel the heartbeat of a character, and then to listen to this character speaking. And so I did that, and I heard the voice of a character that sounded a lot like my mother. And I figured that as an artist, if she wasn't able or willing to tell me her story, then as an artist, I could imagine my way into it. What's really quite surreal about it is that as I started sharing those details with her, it turned out that a lot of them resonated and turned out to be true to her story. So the play is inspired by my mother's story, but there's a lot of synergy, and there's a lot of overlap with what happened, and also, again, what's happening now. You know, my mother brought a lot of her, shared the play with a lot of her friends from high school who are now in L.A. And even some in Orange County. And they, you know, many of them came up to me and said, oh, that was my story, too. You know, that was my story, too. Or this part of it, that's how I am with my son. You know, and then Americans as well, you mentioned so graciously, you know, Americans also really relate to the play because at the end of the day, it's about a mother and son. You know, it's a mother-son dynamic. And the character, who is larger than life, so funny, so over the top in some moments, is also asking really grounded questions that we all have asked at some point, you know, about belonging and family and home. And so, you know, I think everyone has something to connect to in this play. And it's been really exciting. We've taken the piece on tour. We've done the sort of the festival circuit. And we will be actually doing a national tour after this, which I'll tell you about. But as we've taken it, we were at La Mama. We were at the Sundance Institute. We were at Theater Aspen and Ojai Playwrights Conference and all over the place. And as we've taken it around, it's been so fascinating and so touching to see that, like, you know, a queer man in his 20s will connect with the play in one way, and then, you know, a woman in her 80s will also connect with the play. So it's been really cool to see that.
And I want to say that the capacity that I've been told by a wise person who was saying, and I think we talked about this when I met you first time at outside the theater a couple of weeks ago, and the capacity for Persians to compartmentalize very, very profoundly troubling experiences. That same compartmentalization, Michael, is when I'm asking people, have you seen the play? And for those who haven't, they have very mixed feelings. Are they ready to see your play? They have been compartmentalizing their experiences, and they don't know if they can trust you, the playwright, to bring them along these kinds of, you know, family ordeals and the transitions here from Iran to the U.S. So it's an ongoing thing. And I'm here to tell every listener, you got to see the play. I trust that this playwright and this performer has your best interest and will bring you along very responsibly, very joyfully, very, maturely. It's just, it's phenomenal. But it is a thing. There's some persons that are just sort of waiting. They're not so sure they can come. And I'm trying to, you know, nudge them. But that compartmentalization is part of what was your mother's role in giving you the material and patrons who are approaching coming to the play. Those are the factors there. So I want to, you know, when people first walk in, they see this over-the-top stage already set. There's no curtain, anything separating. We just walk in, and it's a phenomenal thing. It looks like it's a super shiny setting, but no. You have made a most subversive lesson about Persian culture with every little flake of every little bit of element that's set up on that stage. So I don't know if you want to crowd in a few minutes how you came up with setting up the table there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to go back to one thing you said about Iranians.
Yes.
You know, what's been so, what I've loved most about this process is that the play is an invitation, I think, to everyone, but especially to Iranians into the theater. And every single night and every time we've done the show, Iranians will come up to me, people who I don't know, and they will say, many of them have not stepped foot inside a theater because there's really no, you know, in the American theater, there's very little instance of our stories being shared on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's also like in the marketing, right? Like we haven't really been speaking to Iranian audiences necessarily in the theater. And so many of them come and share that story. And they also, you know, whatever their background, whatever their experience in Iran, they have shared their deep connection with the story and their joy of just like being able to experience a play that, you know, has Farsi in it and shares in our joy and our festivity. You know, a lot of the stories we hear in the news about Iranians, generally, even before this ongoing movement that's happening right now, were not positive stories. You know, they, I think there was that study, there was a study done a couple of years ago about Iranians in media and how we're portrayed on stage, on screen. And, you know, it said a vast majority of Iranian characters and actors that are portrayed are stereotyped, are portrayed as villainous, they're terrorists. And, you know, I wanted to break free from that stereotype and show, you know, my truth and my family's truth, and bring people into our joy, bring people into our celebration and our tradition and our rich history. And, you know, what's amazing about it is that the character speaks in English, as you know, for the most part, but there are moments where she'll say something in Farsi, and then she'll translate it. And what happens when there are Iranians in the crowd is that the Iranians will laugh, and then the American, and then she'll explain it in English, and then the Americans will laugh. So it creates this really interesting dynamic. And
well, Michael, one thing though, the Iranians, they're also covering their mouths. They're kind of shocked by what they just heard, and we don't know that. We're just sort of blissfully listening. But it, you really provoke with some of the word choices for Farsi speakers.
Yeah, and it's all in fun, right?
Right.
It's all in fun because a lot of those things that she says in Farsi, they're sort of, you know, tongue-in-cheek references, and so she's I think what's interesting is, like, you know, the majority of audiences in that come to the play are American, and the play is written for American audiences as well, but they just don't, you know. I think it's like it's an invitation to be expressive in the theater and to laugh out loud. And, you know, when you're one of a handful of Iranians in an audience, you know, typically it might be like, oh, can I actually laugh at that? And I think this play is really opening up mm-hmm. for people. Yes, you can. You're welcome. This is your space. You know, this is a sanctuary for you. This is a home for you. And you're invited into the door, into the American theater. You know, you're invited into this classically, you know, American context. And, you know, and I mean American context in this town and in where we are here. And you know, we're celebrating Iranianness.
So, Michael, I just
wanted to mention that.
Thank you. I just want to, as a closing question, that putting aside all the other questions, their director, Moritz von Stupnagel, I'd like to know how you two got together. He's got an amazing repertoire. Did you boutique shop for director, or do you two have a special background, a creative acquaintance?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, Moritz is just absolutely brilliant. I mean, I call him Mr. Broadway because he directs every other show on Broadway. You know, not mm-hmm. every show. He can't be doing everything, but he does quite a lot, and he's just a masterful director, a comedy genius as well. We started working together a few years ago. We met through a mutual friend and just really connected over both of our backgrounds, you know, and we started doing Avaz, and I think I told you we took it to a bunch of different places. And it's such a joy to be doing this with Moritz now. I mean, we put together a Tony and Emmy award-winning creative team, and Moritz himself is Tony nominated, of course. But, you know, you mentioned the set. You know, that's Beowulf Barrett, who I think has done 30 Broadway shows and just got nominated for another Tony for New York, New York. You know, the costume was designed by Joshua Domino Schwartz, who I worked with on this TV show called We're Here. He's an Emmy winner, and the costume is absolutely fabulous. It's, you know, larger than life, and really, I think, captures the essence of my mother and the character. And, you know, it's just been beyond, you know, to have this play done in Southern California. You know, I'm told, Claudia, this is the first major production.
Yes.
Of an Iranian play ever in Southern California.
Well, congratulations on that. And Michael, I want to thank you for your time in bringing the tightest, most intimate, an authentic lecture performance on cultures, a story of women, life, and freedom.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's been a joy.
My guest was Michael Sheyan, playwright and performer, about his world premiere, Avaz, which he wrote and stars in, presented at the Segerstrom Repertory at the Segerstrom Center at the Performing Arts in Costa Mesa. The show continues now through May 27th. Details are at scr.org, or you can call 714-708-5555. That's my wrap. Next week, my guests are chemistry professor A.J. Shaka and nuclear power energy strategy expert Mark Nelson, speaking about nuclear energy facilities. And don't forget, the Coup de Comédie is on UCI's campus Wednesday through Saturday this week. Free workshops and live acts. Reservations are required. Talk with you next week. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Money.